Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We have heard over and over that housing and jobs are the key to economic recovery. Consensus seems to be that the housing market is finally turning around. And today, some glimmers of hope for the nation's unemployed workers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at marketplace.ting.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. This is your Marketplace podcast for Friday, August 3rd, 2012. Some rare cheerful-ish news today on the employment situation front. That's Bureau of Labor Statistics code for the job market. The economy added 163,000 jobs in July across the board, from manufacturing to hospitality, teachers and temps. The unemployment rate, though, did tick up from 8.2 to 8.3%. And so we note at this point that jobs are being created, then the economy is churning out more things than it did in the mid-2000s, and yet the workforce has shrunk significantly since the onset of the Great Recession. Now, what gives? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
We are now back to producing about the same amount of goods and services we did before the recession. Slightly more, actually. Airplanes and Happy Meals and Xbox games. But we have 5 million fewer Americans making and serving up all that stuff.
Towards the end of recession, productivity started to grow very, very fast. And then in the early part of the recovery, it did extremely well.
That's Nigel Galt, chief U.S. economist at IHS Global Insight. So I asked him, did we simply weed out the workers we didn't need, the most unproductive ones who just pushed papers and buttons without adding value?
No, I'm not sure that's quite a fair way to characterize it. I mean, I would certainly say that we have managed to get more productivity from the workers that we have, so that we don't need as many as we used to.
And he says chalk that up to new technology, robotic arms that work the assembly line, and software programs that crunch data without as many humans involved. Now, this is pretty much standard operating procedure for the economy, has been for decades. Jobs eliminated by technology, new jobs created by the technology, programmers and service workers and salespeople. But, says Gary Burtless at the Brookings Institution,
at the moment, our shortfall is not a technology-driven, productivity-driven phenomenon. It is a shortfall in the demand for what American workers can produce.
Burtless points out about 2 million of the 5 million jobs that have been lost and not come back, they were construction workers. It's not like they were replaced by robots or better architecture software.
It's very hard to trace that drop in construction employment to any change in technology or productivity.
Another 500,000 or more of the layoffs, government workers. Government didn't get more efficient. We just can't afford them with the tax base we have right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's the latest in seemingly ridiculous Facebook bragging rights. We learned today that Lacoste, they of the famous alligator logo, well, they just hit 10 million Facebook fans. According to the research firm Stylofane, the clothing maker is one of only six fashion brands to hit that mark. Converse leads the list, which also includes Adidas, Burberry, Levi's, and Nike. So what is the big deal for companies who just want to be liked by you? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon says it's a lot more than a popularity contest.
Like, really? We haven't counted this many likes since Valley Girls were all the rage.
Like, I don't know, it's going to be cool, you know, but I'm like, so awesome. It's like tubular. It's just like, I don't know, like totally.
Companies totally love it when you like them, so much so the research firm WebTrends estimates they spend on average a little more than a dollar in promotional costs to motivate that mouse click. Jared Roy heads global client services for WebTrends.
It has more power than someone opting into an email list or a mailing list because they've actively gone out there and said, you know what, I like this brand. I want to receive information from this brand.
Buddy Media consults with companies on their social media advertising. The firm's Joe Ciarallo says some companies spend more than others getting you to like them, but giving away freebies only goes so far.
It's fine to give people a reason to show up and to like, but you want to make sure that they're actually the right people, folks that are generally a fan of our brand, or are they just people who are clicking on this just to get the deal and then never coming back?
Ciarallo says creating your own Facebook community can be an especially effective way to target loyal customers.
Those folks, if you're doing this right, are more likely to buy from you. They're more likely to recommend you to their friends.
There's concern, though, you might not be so quick to like things in the future if you really knew what you're getting yourself into. Just a few weeks ago, Facebook settled a federal class action lawsuit. It agreed to make it clear that when users click like on a company or product, their names and photos could end up being used to promote it. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Congress left for its summer vacation without coming up with a drought relief package for farmers and ranchers. But that doesn't mean they're all left high and dry. A lot of farmers are going to get help from crop insurance, and that could put a crimp in the bottom line of insurance companies and taxpayers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains.
Corn is supposed to be green and tall this time of year. It's not.
It's brown.
Doug Yoder is with the Illinois Farm Bureau. He says it's brown and or short, depending on where you are. But scrawny plants don't always add up to scrawny paychecks. Most corn and soybean farmers, and we're talking big-scale farmers here, have crop insurance. The feds pick up a big part of the tab. Farmers pay the rest.
Anybody that drops a seed in the ground and hopes to make a living on that, you know, you're accustomed to taking risk. But there's also limits to that risk that you can take, and we will be testing those this year. There's no doubt about it.
Crops and farmers aren't the only ones getting stressed. Insurance adjusters are about to get really, really busy driving from one sad field to another.
They're going
to
be long days. This will be a 24/7 process for a while, simply due to the volume of claims that we'll see.
Tom Zacharias heads National Crop Insurance Services, an industry group. He says it's too early to know what the drought will cost, but we're talking billions, which is likely to mean the first loss for crop insurers in a decade and another cost for taxpayers.
The insurance companies and USDA have what's known as a reinsurance agreement.
That's basically insurance for insurance companies.
And both parties share in the underwriting gains of the program as well as the underwriting losses.
This year, that'll be losses. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors broke the four-day losing streak thanks in large part to that employment report. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The word most commonly used to describe the situation in Syria right now is intractable. Well, you could add horrific and desperate to that list. Humanitarian groups around the world are mobilizing their resources, sending money, food, and medicine to the countries bordering Syria. That's because the Syrian government has refused to allow some Western aid groups inside its borders. Michael Coker is Vice President for International Programs at the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, clearly, if there are challenges getting into the country, there are huge ones for anyone trying to get out. Can you paint a picture for us of what a typical family goes through economically when they try to leave Syria? What kind of money are we talking about in terms of getting out of town?
Sure. I'll begin by saying that the majority of refugees leaving are women and children, about 75% women and children. There are no organized convoys crossing borders. It's a perilous journey, very dangerous travel. There are high instances of rape, of robbery. Many people have had whatever meager possessions they have had looted. We have to remember that many of them have had their homes destroyed, everything taken, even before they flee. Once they reach the border, there is safe passage, surely, into Jordan. But when they arrive, most of them have very little money. We have to remember a couple things. First of all, Syria is a very poor country. The per capita GDP is about $5,000 a year. That's like Guatemala or Swaziland. And then they're arriving into Jordan, which has a per capita GDP of around $6,000. And that's like Angola. It's expensive to live in Jordan, much more expensive than it is to live in Syria. Just to get a single room with a host family is $130 a month, ballpark. Mm. It's $250 a month for a very small apartment. Most can't even afford that. The economic toll of this is substantial. And the longer this goes on, the worse it's going to get.
If the women and children are arriving with what little money there was, then what does that leave for the men who stay behind?
It leaves very little. Families are having to make very, very difficult choices. They have little to begin with. generally, the women and children are taking the lion's share of that money with them, but it's a very small amount. And we're seeing many of the families that we're working with, they run out of money within a week's time, surely in 4, 5, 6 weeks' time. Jordan is plagued already with the tremendous water shortages. So a lot of people are living without water, without electricity, very limited access, if any, to health care.
You mentioned water issues, and I wonder, what are some of the other economic issues of the cities where these refugees are ending up?
Well, poor infrastructure, difficult sanitation services, and high unemployment. In that part of the country, it's more impoverished, for example, than around Amman, the capital. So you do have a very high rate of unemployment. And in any event, refugees in Jordan are unable to work legally. So if they can work at all, it is sort of on the black market economy where they're paid very little. Most of them can't work and do not work. And whatever money they have is dwindling. It's a very difficult situation. They are very much in limbo. There is no prospect of returning home at all right now to Syria. And obviously, it's very, very unclear how long this highly complex situation might go on.
The UN Special Envoy, Kofi Annan, essentially threw up his hands this week and said, I don't know what else I can do at this point. As an NGO on the ground there, do you see any ray of hope in this situation with Syria right now?
Well, it's difficult to see a ray of hope. And again, I can't really speak to the geopolitical or the military aspects of what's happening. We stick to our humanitarian mandate, and we stay in that lane. It's very difficult, however, to be optimistic. It's clearly an intractable situation that is worsening, and increased numbers of refugees are flowing not only into Jordan, but into Lebanon, into Turkey, and now even into Iraq.
Michael Coker is Vice President for International Programs at the International Rescue Committee. He's been speaking with us from New York. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It is hot all across the country, probably will be this weekend too. Earlier this week, we talked with Daniel Engber, a writer for Slate, who defended the use of air conditioning. The vast majority of Americans have air conditioning, and a lot of you kind of love it, as you posted on our Facebook page. Take a listen.
I don't feel the slightest bit of guilt for using air conditioning. It's my electricity because I paid for it.
That's like asking if I'm pro-oxygen.
Air conditioning is one of the greatest achievements in Western culture, perhaps one or two levels just below the printing press itself. Nobody should ever try to make us feel guilty for working indoors in comfort through the summer heat, humidity. It lets us be productive all year long.
That's one side. Here's the other, again from our Facebook page.
Hate it with a passion. Always makes me sick.
I wish more residential houses built in the Southwest were built more smartly. Making houses more airtight would reduce the need for cooling and heating.
It wastes quite a bit of energy, drives up your electricity bill, and makes you less tolerant of the beautiful summer weather outside your house.
All right, tell us what you think on Facebook or at marketplace.org. Coming up, Silicon Valley's summer camp for young techies.
My parents keep telling me the economy is really bad, so working on computers, it makes a lot of money right now.
Indeed, but first, let's do the numbers. And we are sending off the week in style. The Dow packed on 1 2/3%, 217 points to close at 13,096. The Nasdaq zoomed up 2%, that's 58 points to end at 2967. The S&P jumped 1 9/10%, 25 points to finish at 1390. Despite mostly down days, the Dow did finish the week 2/10% higher. The Nasdaq gained 3/10% and the S&P was up 4/10%. Job growth at home and good news out of Europe produced a double dose of optimism. Morgan Stanley ascended 5 3/4%. J.P. Morgan Chase increased more than 2.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Ting, the new mobile service that makes sense, bringing billing clarity, usability, and savings to mobile phone users. Ting bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. Ting has no premiums or penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. Businesses and families can have unlimited devices on an account. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage. Save $50 on your device at marketplace.ting.com. That's marketplace.ting.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the U.S. Department of Education hosts a two-day bullying prevention summit. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee holds a field hearing in Burlington, Vermont. It'll discuss gas prices in that state. And the Olympics continue with medals awarded in gymnastics, sailing, and track and field. Makes me think about hitting the gym. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. As we talked about earlier, jobs numbers are out today. More added, but the percent unemployed ticked up slightly. And as Mitchell Hartman reported, there are fewer of us working, but we are doing more. And believe it or not, folks, it has been a year since U.S. debt was downgraded by the credit rating firm S&P. It was all apocalypse and Armageddon then, but did it really matter? Well, here with some perspective, our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and John Carney from CNBC. Happy Friday, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Tess. Happy Friday.
So we heard Mitchell up top the broadcast talking about the monthly jobs report released today. More jobs added, but this unemployment rate just ticked up. Heidi, let me start with you. Good news, bad news, no news?
It's certainly better news, right? Because we've seen so many months of the job news getting worse and worse. And so this reverses that trend. And it also fits in with other good economic data we've seen, like housing prices seem to have hit a bottom and consumer confidence is up for reasons that we cannot even fathom. So all of those things tie together to add at least 1 month of optimism. But I think we should have to wait a few more months to get a real read.
No, I don't want to.
I think it's a very, very good sign for the economy. I actually think with unemployment ticked up, but it's basically flat. The numbers, it was an insignificant change. Getting these kind of jobs based on, despite all the fears we've had about Europe and all the fears about perhaps we're sliding into another recession, maybe an indicator that the economy is recovering on a self-sustaining basis. Remember, this isn't being driven by government growth, more spending, anything like this. It looks like we're having a actual, real, self-sustaining economic growth emerging here.
Well, the markets certainly were very happy at the news this morning, as we heard in the numbers. What does it mean when the markets respond that way to something like this, Heidi?
Generally, it means that they've woken up from a deep nap. I mean, it is August, and there aren't a lot of people on the job right now. And we also had some miserable news in the markets with the trouble with one particularly large trading firm called Knight Capital. Mm-hmm. So any evidence of good news would, of course, create a rally. But as we know, the market does not stand by its convictions. It's a bit moody. So it will be a different picture on Monday, I'm sure.
Well, speaking of Moody, which is a credit rating agency, let's turn now to the fact that we are 1 year out from the S&P downgrade, another rating agency. As I said, I can't believe it's been a year. We had you two on the wrap that day to talk about it. Where is the apocalypse that we were all promised, John?
It never emerged. As Heidi and I actually explained, I think, a year ago, the ratings downgrade was a very silly exercise. Moody's has no expertise in whether the U.S. government is ever going to default on its debt in some way. That's not going to happen. And if you look at the interest rates of the 10-year notes since we got downgraded, they've pretty much done nothing but fall. We have lower interest rates now than we did before we were downgraded. The whole thing was a ridiculous exercise in faux-pocalypse rather than apocalypse.
Yeah, and at the time, Heidi, you said it was largely psychological. It certainly seems to have proven to be true.
Yes, exactly. It's like the worst Michael Bay movie in history, right? You expect, you know, fireworks and you get nothing. You get like a sad trombone. But actually, it actually could be another kind of movie trope, which is, you know, the horror movies where you walk into a room, you think you've avoided the villain, and then he's waiting behind the door for you, another door for you. And that could happen. I mean, the things that S&P was complaining about last year are still true. We still borrow too much. We still have too much debt. We have the debt ceiling problem is probably going to reoccur this year. We have something called the fiscal cliff, which involves, you know, tax breaks that may run out. We have those problems. We're just not paying the price right now. So we shouldn't get too smug.
Well, so basically, basically if S&P was trying to send a message, which it seemed to indicate that that's what it was trying to do, you know, Congress, get your act in order. Mm-hmm. Washington apparently did not get that message.
No, they didn't get it at all. And, you know, I'm not that bothered. I'd rather have Congress respond to voters than to a ratings agency. I thought it was extremely arrogant for S&P to attempt to issue orders to the rating to Congress. Again, you know, this is a democracy. We don't have to have, you know, bureaucratic pinheads telling us how to balance our budget. We'll balance it just how we want to or not.
Which is at the last minute and hysterically.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Par for the course. All right. Heidi, John, hey, happy weekend, you guys.
You
Thanks.
Too.
You too.
There was a time way back when I was a kid that summer camp meant tents and s'mores and songs by the campfire. Well, today we have soccer camp and volleyball camp and drama camp and, well, no surprise here, technology camp. Thousands, make that tens of thousands of kids are spending a good chunk of the summer in front of a screen with their parents' blessing at tech camp. Marketplace's Queen of Kim met up with some of them recently in Silicon Valley.
Ah, the sounds of summer. Families getting together for barbecues, dogs running around, and 9-year-old Alex is plopped down on a lounge chair, totally engrossed in his favorite iPad game, which prompts this from his dad.
Alex, lose the iPad.
Chances are, these words are being heard across the country. But a growing number of parents are taking the opposite tack.
So this is the course that uses Game Salad, and this is the course that uses Xcode, so...
Welcome to ID Tech Camp. It started 13 years ago with 200 students in Silicon Valley. Today, ID Tech says it has about 23,000 campers in 25 states. 1 week at the camp can cost up to $1,400. And that comes with the usual camp activities like swimming, games, and nighttime pranks.
It's the Pac-Man sound.
Savannah's a 10th grader and was at an ID Tech camp at UC Berkeley, where about 70 students, ages 7 to 17, were making video games or, like Savannah, an app for iPod Touch.
And we're going to open up your project here.
Savannah's counselor was teaching her how to load her app onto her iPod.
So if I go home, will this download on my sister's iPod too?
I asked Savannah why she thinks tech camps are becoming more popular.
My parents keep telling me the economy is really bad, so working on computers, it makes a lot of money right now.
Wow, how old are you again?
I'm 14.
Once upon a time, my parents told me something very similar. They tried to push me into math and science, but it just wasn't sexy back then.
When I was young, everyone was playing basketball or they were really practicing hard in baseball, and they were like, I'm going to be the next LeBron James or Barry Bonds.
Meet Anshul. He's 15, and he says a lot's changed since he was a kid.
As we've been growing older, app creating is cool. It's, you know, the new thing.
And being the next Steve Jobs or Google's Larry Page or Mark Zuckerberg, it's like being a celebrity.
Oh, it would be great if you could open up the Chrome browser.
I met Anshul at Google's summer camp, known as CAPE, which stands for Computer and Programming Experience. It's one of the hottest tech camps around. The camp is free, and in addition to learning the basics of computer science, campers get to meet Silicon Valley luminaries. This year, 600 campers applied for 120 spots. Today's day one. 30 campers are sitting around a large conference room, making their first Android app. It's a picture of a kitty, and when you touch it, it meows.
Those of you that are playing your cats, try really hard not to do that right now.
Ria Galanos has been teaching math and computer science in Atlanta for about 10 years. She's been teaching at Google's summer camp for the last two. She says tech camps have become more popular in part because it's cheaper and easier than ever to start one up.
When I became a computer science teacher, my county had to purchase software. Someone had to install it on the machines.
And it was really expensive and not very kid or consumer friendly. And the run-of-the-mill computer didn't always cut it.
And so after you open up the browser, the website is just appinventor.mit.
App Inventor is a free software that Google and MIT developed. And it lets you create an Android app in about 20 minutes. It's a simple app, probably not the kind of thing that's going to make you rich, but it's enough to spark a young techie's interest. And that brings us back to Anshul. This is his second year at the camp. The game he and his fellow camper developed last summer is headed for the Android App Store. And he'll start making something new this summer.
You can do more things and more things and more things. There's no limit to this.
unlike Anshul's favorite subject, math.
I love doing math competitions, but it's really hard to create new things. Math started ever since the ancient Greeks, and now it's been to a state where it's getting more and more perfected.
And Anshul says he's unlikely to perfect perfection. But with apps?
Apps, on the other hand, is in the age as if it was the Greeks.
Like a lot of campers I spoke to, Anshul feels he's at the dawn of a new era. And even as a kid, he can be a player. In Silicon Valley, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, a look back at the news of the week that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Newnham and Rico Galliano, with some help from the Marketplace staff.
Millie Jefferson, director, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So the headline that grabbed my attention this week is Missile Defense Staff Warned to Stop Surfing Porn Sites.
Now, why would that capture your attention? Wow. So was it an epidemic of this?
Well, to be fair, there are 8,000 employees that work for the Missile Defense Agency at the Pentagon. Less than a half dozen people's computers showed that they had accessed these kinds of sites.
Okay. And actually, didn't the Department of Defense kind of invent the internet? Like the early internet?
That's a good point. You know, you reap what you sow.
Yeah. You made this sleazy bed, DOD.
Mark Garrison, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Story I read in BuzzFeed. It's about Kickstarter, very popular crowdsourced online funding, good to raise some money to do your movie or that kind of thing. And it has gotten so popular that it has spawned an entire industry of consultants who will help you raise money on Kickstarter.
So let me get this straight. If you wanted to raise money on Kickstarter, you would pay me money to help you raise money on Kickstarter?
Yeah, but you may actually have to start your own Kickstarter campaign so that you can fund your consultancy to then charge me.
So eventually you're going to need a Kickstarter campaign for your legal defense fund because you're running a Ponzi scheme.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, Wealth and Poverty Reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
In Prescott, Arizona, police were called in because someone tried to buy stuff with counterfeit $100 bills.
Okay, so?
Well, what tipped them off is there was Lincoln on the $100 bill instead of Benjamin. It's all about the Lincolns.
Did they get him?
So far, they haven't caught him.
I hope that the cops are looking also for whoever sold this guy his counterfeit education.
Rico and Brendan do a radio show. It's called The Dinner Party, and there is a link to it at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 1.67% to 217 points. The NASDAQ zoomed up 2%. That's 58 points. And the S&P 500 jumped 1.9%, 25 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Satara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend, our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, kicks off a series of conversations about religion and money. First up, the basics of finance for Muslims.
Money cannot be stored in banks or under the mattress or in the pillow. It got to be invested back in the community.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.